Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hardcore is a new series from Heritage Radio Network. Over six episodes, we're taking a close look at the rebirth of American cider.
Really, it wasn't until about 10 years ago that cider started to be revitalized in the United States.
From the science of fermentation.
So yeast, it's a fungus, it's a unicellular fungus.
To the magic of terroir.
What really excites us is thinking about communicating that very sort of spiritual aspect of knowing a piece of land.
We're setting aside our cider donuts to gain a deeper understanding of this singular beverage.
I love a cider donut. You don't have to have a cider donut with your cider, and I will die on that point.
Subscribe to Hardcore wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good morning. Today is Thursday, November 14th. There's quite a chill outside. I'm Emily Pearson, and I'm here with my co-host, Brandon Hoy.
I feel so weird today. I'm sitting in Patrick's chair, and it smells over here.
Does it?
It's weird.
Still, since last
it's
Thursday?
Gross.
Oh, man.
I don't know what he does.
I mean,
we'll clean the
headphones for you.
Comfortable in his chair. You notice when he's not here, usually I still sit in my own chair.
I know.
It's
I gave away
here.
your seat to our guests today.
That was very kind of you. They probably don't want to sit in this seat. It's like the microphone smells.
Speaking of Patrick, he's in Kansas City awaiting the
gobble,
arrival.
Gobble,
gobble. Gobble, gobble. You got something on the sampler for that?
I
a
don't.
Noise for that one?
No.
No?
I don't think this thing even works anymore.
Oh, we're not even plugged in. No. All right. No. Well, Patrick is loading thousands of turkeys starting today that are going to go out around the country to our wholesale customers at Heritage Foods and mail order. Thanksgiving is one holiday you really don't want to screw up. It is important to everybody.
See, I don't eat turkey. And Patrick knows this.
I know.
I remember we talked about it this year.
I mean, maybe we're gonna.
It's just not my thing.
All right. Fair enough. What about side dishes?
I love all the side dishes. All the side dishes. I'll take all the side dishes. Just turkey is not really my thing.
All right. Fair enough.
I usually, I'll do like a duck.
What about stuffing? I mean, bread's so important for Roberta's in your
stuffing.
Life.
I love stuffing.
Do you bring home Roberta's bread for your stuffing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we actually make stuffing here, so.
Really?
We have like the little, yeah, it's nice.
Can I buy it? Can I take it home?
I don't know.
What do you mean? It's maybe. Like an in-house, only if maybe. You know a guy?
Yeah.
I mean, I know a guy, don't I?
I don't think you do.
Ooh. Oh, boy.
I don't know. Emily, for you, probably.
All right. In other news, we celebrated the 10th anniversary of this wonderful, awesome station, Heritage
Amazing.
Radio Network.
10 years.
I know.
This
shipping container is still standing. Roberta's is going strong.
I'd like to say that was when I had hair, but I didn't have hair then either.
No. I mean, you wear a hat.
Also gray.
You wear a hat every day.
Nothing really changed.
Well, it was at the Brooklyn Botanic Gardens. It was beautiful. We had a new sort of like entryway this year. There was a photo booth at the start. Amazing, like awesome carving stations, wine. We had some really cool chefs that were involved from Momofuku Nishi and Oto. Chef Marjorie came up from St. Anselm. We had Park Avenue had this like spread with leaves everywhere. They know how to do a tablescape for sure. So.
And did you invite any veterans?
There were actually when Katie got up on the stage, it was on Veterans Day, and she did a little thank you, and there was a good round of applause. So I think there were for sure a few in the house.
Nice,
but It was a celebration. And Katie was just featured yesterday. Our executive director was in Eater. Mm. She had a really cool piece for the Eater Young Guns session. And so shout out to her. And Brandon, your commissary kitchen is now next door.
Wow. It happened.
It happened.
It took me forever.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
So everything's sort of under one roof.
It's getting there. I'm still at I still have frozen pizza at Pfizer.
Okay.
But it's happening. It's all coming together.
So eventually, can you like take over all of Moore Street? Who do you have to buy out next door?
This is not space. This is space I've had for years. I've just figured out a way to kind of consolidate everything. But we've had that space forever. It's just
installing refrigeration and all that good stuff.
Yeah, you know how fun it is.
All right. Well, so in studio, we have some really special guests with us today. We have husband and wife, sheep farming duo, and authors of Coyotes in the Pasture and Wolves at the Door, John and Suki Jameson of Jameson Farm in Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning.
You guys are no strangers to Heritage Radio Network. You were telling me before that last year you were on with Linda Palacio.
Yes, we were.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah,
does the studio look any different to you?
No.
We found our way.
You recognized it for sure. Well, welcome back. We're really excited to have you. And I know last night you said you were at ICE with Bill Telepan doing a lamb demo.
Yeah, Suki and Bill were cutting it. I was talking. And as Suki says, she does all the thinking. I do all the talking.
Well, I noticed from your book, it's the memoir vignettes are mostly written in your voice. And then the recipes segue to Suki, it seems.
Right.
All right. Well, we're going to let her talk a little bit today, right?
I hope.
So we always like to open our show with a game of word association. So we do this kind of quick. First word association for Suki, Julia Child.
Tasty but tough.
Oh, I like that. Tasty but tough. And your other one, shepherd's pie.
Who said beef is in shepherd's pie?
So what's in yours?
What do you think?
Oh, come on.
Lamb. Is it braised or is it ground?
Usually ground, yep.
Awesome. And then it's topped with, I saw there was a picture in the book, mashed potatoes and no crust. Just
the mashed potatoes.
Fantastic.
I might actually do lamb for Thanksgiving this year.
That was going to be a question later in the show. I thought we could talk about some lamb centerpieces. Why not? Heritage Foods can help you out with some lamb. The Jamesons can also help you out with some lamb.
Yeah. It sounds delicious. I feel like by the end of the show, it might not even make it till Thanksgiving. It might have to happen tonight.
I think it's going to be this weekend or tonight for sure. John, word is delivery, shipping, trucking.
A pain in the neck.
Sounds right.
Yeah.
How do you do most of your delivery?
Now we do most everything UPS. Because where the farm is, one of the great advantages is that we're only 10 miles from a big UPS center. And FedEx also. They compete. But UPS is doing better with ground.
That's great. For us at Heritage Foods, it's such a key thing. You know, if you're within a ground zone versus like when we ship things out of our Kansas City processing plant, ground does not pick up there. It's only 25 miles north of Kansas City or so.
And they won't pick up.
You can do like special requests, but it's not a standard like ground zone. So we end up being in that, you know, 2-day air. So we try to ship everything out of New York or out of California.
Really?
Because the ground zone out of New York is great. Yeah. Brandon, do you ship?
Which doesn't really make sense. You would think like in the middle of the United States, so centralized that they would actually have a better logistics and ground zone.
But I think if we can ask Paradise to drop off, well, first of all, what's also weird to me is if they miss their express pickup or like they're packing a box at the last minute, they just go and drop it off at the airport and it's like no big deal. I mean, it just shows you like what would you do if you showed up at LaGuardia? Be like, I'm just here to drop off.
Right, like 25 turkeys.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I'm like,
Keith, a casket box of lamb pieces.
Yeah. I'm like, Keith Lou, I need one more thing. And they're like, all right, we'll have our guy go past. He drives past the airport on his way home anyway. And I'm like, what do you just leave it? They're like, there's a FedEx area. And in New York, it doesn't work.
Our shipping is more difficult, though. I mean, none of you guys do frozen completely, right?
Us? Ours is? We do.
Sure, we do. Yeah.
Right. So I guess it's the same.
Yeah. I mean, we're all in the frozen game. Do you guys use dry ice in the summer?
If we have to, but we use gel packs.
Not very often.
Yeah. You try not to.
It's 2 days. If it's longer than 2 days, you're out of luck.
Yeah, see, we can't even do 2 days. So
where are you shipping to?
I mean, I have to do overnight if I ship. So that'd be a gold belly because ours is frozen pizza. So it's like
there's nothing
to hold the
not,
freeze.
It's
the
not freeze. Dense
so
enough.
The second it starts to go, it just turns floppy and then you're screwed.
Right. And do you do your fulfillment out of this block?
We only do some fulfillment. Most of it happens through Gold Belly or, you know, other third-party companies that sell it. so we don't usually do it, but we have 4 or 5 accounts that we do.
You also have this really nice friend next door, Heritage Foods. We sometimes, you know, help you out with the scale and the box.
You do.
That's usually when you're shipping some, like, mother to the West Coast.
Yeah, or, yeah, actually, we've done that a few times. I have shipped frozen pizza from there as well, but it's usually, like, shipping it to somebody as a, like,
yeah, as a
present.
Gift, sure.
Yeah.
All right, John, your other word is Hollywood.
So Hollywood would be Jodie Foster.
Oh, yeah?
Who's in the book.
Are you still friends?
Yes. Yeah, we're
she
friends.
She puts the lotion in the basket. Well, I don't think she put the lotion in the basket, did she? The other creepy guy did.
No,
I know. Silence of the Lambs. I was trying to come full circle here with some lamb jokes.
Yeah, well, that was so we provided the. You're trying to hit the buttons.
Normally, we got a round of applause on that one. Yeah,
that's
good. Ding, ding, ding.
That's good. But she was. She's in the book because the movie was filmed in Pittsburgh, and
right,
and she she's not very tall. So they needed a baby lamb for her to hold, and it ended up in the movie because Hannibal drew a picture of Clarice that he gave to her. When she came to see him in the jail.
Yeah. Wow, the very exciting. The fava beans.
The fava.
Did they
beans.
Name yes. the lamb Jameson?
No. But it was silent.
Yeah. All right. Well, so yeah, for sure. So we regularly talk about Meghan Markle on this show.
Oh, again?
Come on. Do you know who Meghan Markle is?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I had to research, though. I am an old fogey.
No. At least you were not the person who thought we were talking about Angela Merkel.
Who's Angela Merkel?
The German chancellor.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yes.
We had someone answer one of these questions being like, well...
I don't really brush up on my German politics, to be honest.
All right. She is Prince Harry's wife, actress turned Duchess of Sussex. So if you were invited to serve Meghan, Harry, and Archie a single bite of lamb, what preparation and or cut would you choose?
You said.
Didn't I say lamb shank?
No, I said lamb shank, and you said lamb tenderloin.
Tenderloin. Absolutely.
I've never had lamb tenderloin.
Oh, you are missing something.
Yeah. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Is there a particular preparation that you know would be
fast?
For the
nature's fast food.
What does that mean?
Cook it quickly.
Just because it's a small little piece? How big is a lamb tenderloin?
It's about
size of
that
a cigar.
Long. It looks like a cigar.
Wow.
You saute it.
I mean, a pork tenderloin weighs like, you know, 3/4 of a pound to a this pound. So a lamb tenderloin's got to be like a little.
It's like a little Vienna sausage.
Maybe a quarter of a pound.
Is that the most expensive cut of the lamb?
Yeah, but
pretty
we don't.
Much.
Yeah.
You don't sell it independently?
Well, I have a lot of them, especially when chefs take the eye of the loin out and they want only that. I've got a lot of.
You got a lot of tenderloin in the freezer.
I do.
All right. That
so
works.
So I have to package it and sell it.
All right. So you've got the tenderloin. John, the shank?
So, there's so many. But the shank, I would say. Shank and
like
shoulder.
I like a crown roast. I know that's not a bite. Crown. I know that's not a bite.
That's
but, you know,
not a bite, but it's wonderful.
A la crown.
That's great. Crown rack lamb is wonderful.
For a visual, it's a beauty. Yeah.
We could put it on Meghan Markle's head.
Oh, that'd be good.
Just like all the juices.
All the juices are flowing, on little Archie. So you write in your book that you fell into farming because the land that you purchased in Pennsylvania lent itself to sheep. So tell me, as climate changes occur, what food or ingredient will you be saddest to lose because of climate change? And what food do you see yourself gaining? Or are there certain grasses?
If I could have tomatoes all year round, I would love that.
Is that happening with climate change in Pennsylvania?
Not yet. No.
An asparagus, if I can have asparagus.
A longer asparagus season would be nice.
That would be good.
Those are my wish for.
Brandon, what are you getting out of
the North
Fork?
I feel like any of these, like, you know, short season things that you want, strawberries, yeah. Right? Strawberries, right. It seems like it just keeps getting shorter and shorter, the like, really just
crispy. What do you mean? This week we just plummeted, you know, how many degrees from one day to the next.
I know, but this year I feel like strawberry season was, like, super fast. I think, you know, you have, like, ramps, asparagus, all right. of these ones that just, like, I felt like 10 years ago they were a little bit longer, four weeks longer. I feel like they just keep getting shorter.
Do you see that as do your specials change as far as your the menu here or your pizza toppings because of shortened season?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like the like strawberry salad and stuff like that, they're really fun to have, and they're like, you know, 2-3 weeks long now, where they used to be, you know, 6 weeks long. So I don't know if that's direct climate change. I feel like season to season, you just have these kind of things. I just feel like the last two have been shorter.
It's been so wet. It's been so wet. Last year we normally have, and this is the reason why it's a great place for lambs. We have 40 to 45 inches annual rainfall. That's normal. Last year we had 60.
Nice.
It's so
the
wet.
Grass is green.
It's green, but you can't plant things, you can't get in to harvest it, and the grass was getting ahead of me because I couldn't mow it, and then I couldn't move the lambs the same way, and it was wet on their feet and everything. There are a lot of issues. The spring started out the same way this year, actually even more rain,
right?
And then it stopped and got dry. So then, you know,
what does that mean for the lamb? Do they not grow as large? Do they not eat as much because they're not grazing in the same way?
No, it's just that if the grass is great is growing that fast when there's that much rain, the two things that will happen is, number one, you can't get in to mow it. After they get out, you want to mow it down so it rests and it can grow back up again. You can't get a tractor in to mow it. It's just too wet.
Yeah, you're stuck in the mud.
You're stuck in the mud, literally. And then also what will happen is the... there's so much water in the grass that they don't quite grow as well, and you have parasitic potential problems also because of that.
And it starts to become harder to move them as well, right?
Yes.
'Cause you need to move them from piece to piece and give them some, get them walking.
Yeah, and John and Suki were very early in the rotational grazing idea for their sheep. So, how many acres do you have now?
212.
You started with 65. You kicked someone out next door?
No, we moved from one farm to another. We moved to a new farm. But the new farm was 110 acres, and then over the 30 years, we bought 100 more.
Did you bring the farmhouse that you first went to Pennsylvania for with you?
No. Hmm. But it's the one we have now is nice, too.
Well, that's sad.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say, you know, you brought it... Took it apart, moved it over.
No.
So if you could bring back just one person, famous or not, to have a meal with, who would it be and why?
Who are you going to pick?
I know you guys have had some good celebrity chef run-ins over the years. So I don't know, is perhaps someone who put Jameson Farm on the culinary map or?
We'd enjoy another dinner with Julia. Absolutely. Julia Child.
Sure. She's an important person around here at Heritage Radio. There's the Julia Child Scholars, and actually Katie, our executive director, came out of that program, and we've had many radio interns who have come through that scholarship.
She was very important to us.
I know.
She helped us a lot.
You would send her a leg of lamb every year for Easter?
We send one at Easter and her birthday in August every year.
And she loved her lamb, correct?
She did. She did very much. Yeah. And she... And
that's where that tasty from tough.
That's the tasty but tough chapter about how we process lamb now, and which is an interesting story. But certainly Julie, and then I would say also probably Jean-Louis Paladin, who really was the chef that started us.
I was reading in their memoir, so you guys wrote that he sort of put you on the the restaurant chef map, and yes, that you had to pick three, the best and most beautiful lamb to drive to the Watergate Hotel in D.C. And speaking of not using dry ice, I guess you pulled over maybe like 10 times on the way just to check how the ice packs were doing.
Yeah.
What time? It was in May, so it was.
It was in May. It was Memorial Day, 1988. And he needed lamb for a dinner he was doing on Saturday night. He called me on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and he needed it for a dinner he was doing for a congressman on a Saturday night. And I was terrified, and I kept thinking, "What if I kill a congressman?" And now, of course, at my age, maybe that would have been a good idea. I mean, but at the time,
it could have been helpful.
Yeah, it could have been very helpful.
Yeah, you should have asked for the guest list before you unloaded the lamb. And now, is there a chef, or I don't know, is there somebody who you're especially starstruck by that you work with? I know you guys have worked with Danielle Belloud over the years.
Yeah, we work with Danielle. Actually, we did when he did the first James Beard dinner after he won the award for the best restaurant either in the country or New York. I think it was 2000 or something. We took lamb to him for that in. He was cooking at James Beard House, and this is when Danielle was where Cafe Belloud is now, mm-hmm. in Surrey, and my car broke down, and they forgot to order, and my car broke down. I was delivering on Monday of the day of the dinner, and I broke down in New Jersey, and I didn't get into...
What a beautiful place to break down as
I'll tell you.
Just outside the Lincoln Tunnel.
Yeah.
I love it.
It was... So Danielle was... There's a picture of him in the book, and he looks like hell. Because we were all Frenching racks in the bottom of the restaurant in the cellar where the kitchen was at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon for dinner that started the Beard House on 12th. It's 6.
Did you factor in New York City traffic and transportation?
Oh, it was terrible.
Yeah, those are the good stories. It and obviously, do you still UPS slam to him?
On occasion, not all the time. We said who would be regular, I guess, around New York would be Dan Barber. We sell to him.
Stone
all the
Barnes.
Time. Yeah, Stone Barnes and Blue Hill in the city.
And, that's fantastic. Yeah. He's a wonderful chef, and I know that he likes to support local and high quality and things that he doesn't raise himself.
Yeah.
But cool. He uses every little bit of every lamb.
Which is
He's
great.
Amazing.
So you ship him a whole animal?
On occasions, yeah.
But necks is what he first really started buying. When he started Stone Barns, he asked me, he said, "What do you have that's really cheap?" And I said, "Nothing, Dan. Come on, you know better." But anyway, he wanted to use necks. He said, "Look at everybody I have in the kitchen. I need something cheap." I said, "Okay." So he started necks, and it started this big craze for lamb necks, which has carried on.
Yeah, we get a lot of requests for them, actually, at Heritage, and we just don't have enough. You know.
How about ears? Nobody's doing ears.
Let's pig just do ears for sure. Does anybody like lamb ears?
No.
Are they too...
It's too
woolly.
They're too literally too woolly, and you have to trim the head off, and it's too much.
Yeah, we have to skin the heads.
So I know you guys are. I mean, everyone in this room is very well versed in the New York City restaurant scene. So, is there a specific food or kind of restaurant that you think New York needs because we don't have it, or because we have it but it's just not good enough? Like, what's missing?
Is there anything missing?
I don't think
there's
so.
There's so much in New
There's
York.
So much.
I don't know. Maybe you're saying a lamb-only restaurant. No. But
that's
I don't
not
know.
A bad idea.
What's not...
You think that doesn't exist?
No. I mean, I don't know. There's chicken-focused restaurants. I don't know there's a lamb-only.
Are there chicken-focused restaurants?
Yeah. No, they're always called pollo or something.
Or poulet.
Poulet.
There was the chef... what's her name? Georgina, I'm blanking on her name. She had a rotisserie chicken place for a little bit. Yeah, I think people are focused just on that. But no, I don't know what's missing in New York. You might say good tacos, but people like Los Tacos over in Chelsea.
I think that if you really hunt it down, there's just about everything in New York.
There is.
It's probably what makes this so magical and such a culinary destination. There really is almost everything here. You just some things are harder to find than others, but
do you have a place you always come to when you visit New York? because you can't get it in Pennsylvania, or you dream of coming back for it?
We just love to come here. It's like a vacation.
I guess we're tacky enough as far as capitalists go, or trying to be. That's what the Wolves at the Door part's about. That we usually go to restaurants that we sell to that are friends of ours.
Absolutely.
So, you know, going to see Billy, how bad can that be?
Yeah.
You know, same sort of thing.
And you probably follow, you know, Bill Telepan, who you were cooking with last night, is a good friend, and now he's at Oceana. Right. And
wherever he's cooking, we'll go. And that's
great.
And he
still uses lamb at the fish restaurant.
Oh, for sure. He uses bacon, too. We work with him for, bacon on their menu.
Yeah.
Yeah, come on. You can't be a fish restaurant and not incorporate some of your favorite, most delicious
So if you had an
all-lamb
restaurant.
You have to bring in some fish, maybe some oysters.
Yeah.
No?
Maybe a little bacon.
You guys, I know your daughter who grew up on the farm with you, Eliza, she's a chef now.
Yeah.
And you said she has a few places in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, she works at a place called Muddy Waters, which is an oyster bar, and then they have two restaurants with it, fast chicken place and a sushi. But she went to CIA, and she did her externship at Cafe Balloon and worked at La Bernardin when she was 22 or something. So she worked for Eric for about a year and a half.
I mean, that's a fantastic resume and great people to learn from.
Yeah.
And we often talk on this show about, you know, like ascending food cities and how so many people who have come out of New York training go back to wherever they're from or to go to another city to do something that's, you know, special and unique and where it's a little less saturated.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh a cool food city?
Pittsburgh thinks it is. But when we started, and that's why we started shipping all over the place. In the late 80s, when we really started shipping to Jean-Louis and other people, it was surf and turf in Pittsburgh was carp and kolbasi.
Mm. Sounds delicious. Like all together, right? Yeah, right. With like French fries.
Much.
And
right. The sandwich, the permane sandwich, is a sandwich with French fries on top of it. It's Pittsburgh.
You know what's funny about that? You go to Italy and you go to like the Auto Grill, which actually has decent sandwiches, shockingly. We would never say that in the U.S. There's always French fries in sandwiches there. But that's
really?
It's such a weird thing.
But it's not as gross. Here,
why? Just because you're in Italy? All
maybe.
Of a sudden,
maybe
like,
there's
this
something
is
very
as,
romantic about it all. Yeah.
Could be. I don't know. But what happened with Permane's was it was historically when it started, it was in the Strip District of Pittsburgh where they got all the produce. And people would eat their breakfast there at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning or dinner, depending what shift they were on. So they wanted big sandwiches with more bounce to the ounce, and that's
you gotta fill that gut.
What do you call a sandwich in Pittsburgh? Is it like a hoagie, a hero? Is there a different?
No, it's a sandwich.
Just a sandwich. Yeah. Doesn't matter what it's on. Like here we have a what do we call them here?
Yeah,
heroes.
I don't know.
Hoagies,
you know,
very
I'm from
Philly.
California. I still call a sandwich most of the times. Hoagie,
a torta,
a hero.
Yeah, it depends.
What a torta. All right, fine. So, what is everyone's favorite lamb dish to eat or cook? And Suki, you talk about some signature dishes in the book. You know, is there a particular recipe that you've spent years perfecting?
Most of my recipes were home recipes we did over and over and over again. So they're well tested for sure. And Bill picked out one out of the book, the lamb paprika, because he grew up having chicken paprika. So he thought, let's try this with lamb.
He didn't think it was going to work. And it's really wonderful. It's Eastern European. He's Eastern European.
Yeah.
And so we were talking about that, and he put everything together except the sour cream. He said, I held the sour cream. And I said, Bill, you can't have it. He said, I'm putting it in.
I have to imagine that I had that at some point. My grandmother loved chicken paprika, but she also loved lamb. We had lamb almost every time I went to her house. So
really?
I have to imagine that at some point she
probably
tried that.
Did.
I just can't imagine that that didn't slip by her, lamb paprika.
It's so tasty.
I love cumin lamb.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I like, when people do like a lamb bolognese. I like it in a pasta. It has to be sort of, you know, as you guys talk about in your book, the lamb has to have the right flavor and it can't be too, you know, greasy.
No,
and I guess it definitely does depend on what the lamb
is
fed.
If it's grass lamb, well, we have a recipe there for it, which you probably saw. And it's unbelievable. It's because lamb is grass lamb. And if it's raised on feedlots, what happens is the oil from the corn goes to the fat.
Yeah.
And that's what makes lamb taste greasy. And that's why Americans generally don't like lamb, because it's fed a lot like that. And but when it's on grass, it's totally different.
So are you guys 100% grass, or there's no point where they're no. well fed?
The ewes, the mothers, when they're
feeding,
oftentimes we'll give them some if the weather's really bad,
right? Just to give them some insulation, and
right.
It helps them produce lactate, right?
So. Right. So, but we don't. So, we'll put the rams in, and actually, in about 2 weeks, they'll be very happy. In 2 weeks, and so will the ewes, and then it's a 5 month gestation period, and so they'll lay them in May. So the grass is really, really good when they're coming out. So the udders are big. They're producing a lot of milk, and mm-hmm. then so the lamb gets right on the udder, and it's doing well on milk. But then when it goes off milk, the grass is incredible. So it's best time to do it.
So you guys are
timed them perfectly.
Yes,
I mean
a cocktail first, and then ready right into dinner.
So is with pigs, the gestation period is 3 months, 3 weeks, and 3 days. Is the lamb gestation period quite as precise? Like 5 months almost to the day?
Pretty much 5 months.
Is that right?
I don't know. Yeah, like, do you have to be careful when you go on vacation? You're like, this is the day.
You figure you put them in 5 months, or in 5 months you start to look for them.
Sure.
And then it'll be whenever the...
It'll be with... I mean, we don't worry about it the same way. It's the way we do it, they're just out on the grass. And so it'll start, the first day will start. We'll figure 1 day. And they usually start a couple days before that, and then they'll go for 2 or 3 weeks.
Do they? And that's fine. Does each mother only have one baby?
We try to have two. You try to average two, because she's got two faucets. So you try to. That's what you try to shoot for. Three is kind of hard, and one you aren't getting everything that you should out of them, and they do better if they're over 2 years old. When they're ewe lambs, meaning the first, they're having lambs and they're just a year old, they don't know what happened often. What the hell's this, you know? And so they don't mother as well as they might.
They're young and immature. Their minds aren't fully ready to be moms.
High school mothers.
High school mothers. I like that. First timer. I love that. And are you guys at all in the wool business or in the cheese making business, or completely just lambing?
Just lambs. When we started, there weren't 30 years ago, there just weren't the right breeds available for milk. And wool is when you can buy a sweater like this, you know, for what they cost, it's not worth it. So we just concentrated on doing lamb.
That kind of goes with your philosophy that you talk about in the book about, you know, don't buy local unless the quality is actually there. You know, local doesn't mean it tastes better unless it's done properly. So
exactly.
If you can buy a sweater that's better or more cost effective, you know, why try to reinvent the wheel?
The way we look at it,
But also that's how markets become stronger as well, because now the competition, like if somebody wants to do it locally, they have something to aspire to be, right? You want to be better. If people just buy you because you're local, not because of the quality, you're never going to improve the quality, right? So you know, that type of purchasing helps a competitive market.
That's
you
true.
Know I love a competitive market.
I know. Who are you competing with these days? DiGiorno?
Every day. Every day competing against DiGiorno. Do they still exist?
I have no idea. You know, I don't know.
I'm sure
I grew up here in New York City, and not to say that frozen pizza wasn't, you know, I guess it just wasn't our family's
frozen
thing.
Frozen pizza was like when you brought home too many slices and you just put one in
your
freezer. You
actually should see my fridge. Yeah. This week we ordered, Tuesday was freezing, we ordered pizza, and, you know, like you're always going to buy the biggest pie because you want to have more.
Yeah.
So I've got, you know, 4 pieces in the fridge, another 4 in the freezer, and I don't need, the Roberta's frozen pizza is wonderful.
Thank you. I knew you were going to come back to it.
Of course.
She did.
Of course. But no, in New York, we take it for granted. We take it for granted in New York. You just call for delivery.
Yeah.
Almost 24 hours.
That's New York.
I don't even know about almost anymore. I'm pretty sure you can call for delivery 24 hours.
Yeah, but what time does Roberta stop letting caviar pick up?
Well, I didn't say you could get Roberta's every 24 hours, but if you want pizza, I'm pretty sure you can find it 24 hours a day.
So let's talk about legacy. A lot of chefs are making comebacks here in New York. Alfred Portale has a new restaurant. Pastis reopened over the summer. Daniel Boulud, you know, continues to go strong and do really well. Do you believe a legacy can survive in restaurants? And what happens when there's new ownership or when an executive chef leaves? Do people keep you on as a lamb source? Or is it if a chef walks out the door, that's it?
It's a good question. I'm glad you asked it because I was trying to figure it out exactly how to answer it. What happens with us, I think, over the years has been when we pick up a new restaurant, it oftentimes is a chef that worked for Danielle or somebody. His background, his resume.
Sure.
And so they know us because they use the lamb when they work for somebody else. But I think what Danielle has done by keeping going is great. We were talking about Pastis last night because Bill worked for Alfred. So, it's interesting. We have a chef in Atlanta, Annie Quattrano, that has Bacchanalia, and she's bought from us she told me, 31 years, which is the first year we started, basically. And she was in New York. She had a restaurant, worked for a restaurant in New York then.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. I mean, that stuff is great.
What's the furthest you ship for a chef who has worked with you before? You know, do you guys ship to the West Coast or do you sort of have a cutoff?
We do on occasions, yeah. It's not constant.
We aren't shipping anybody now. Are we?
Right. Not right now.
When Shea Panisse calls, when Alice Waters says when she needs calls, lamb.
When she comes east, she likes to
she
use our
lamb. She uses us when she comes east. And she also did, she admitted this to me, in front of some people, that she, before she could find the lamb she wanted there, she bought from us for a while.
Well, that's Alice's thing, too. You know, she likes to know her ranchers, and she likes to know the source, and she'd like it to be from California, but she'll always tell you if she can't find it locally.
That's right.
And if the quality is not there, then...
Yeah, she's
a source elsewhere.
What really the book, not to hit with the book right away, but what happened was in the 80s, what was so much fun was that you had Jean-Louis buying from local farms on the East Coast because he came from an area, part of the world that didn't have refrigeration really, and everything was cooked by the season. And then you had Alice, who was a Francophile, and just loved that, and she was doing it on the West Coast, and it was all happening at the same time, and it was really kind of cool, because there were all these young chefs doing this, but there were only so many purveyors at that time that were stupid enough to do it, I would say.
Well, and that you were stupid. Also, you know, doing your own butchering and breaking down cuts and being able to not just sell whole lamb.
Yeah, but we didn't buy the plant until 94. It became available, and Suki really wanted the plant because she was making prepared products because we couldn't sell the offcuts at that time. We couldn't sell shoulders and shanks. And so we made two different stews, three different sausages, and a barley soup. And by buying the plant, we were able to do all that there.
Because you were inspected and you could do...
because of USDA.
Where you were USDA. And did you ship your prepared foods or they were all like farmer's market style where people could
we
just pick up
everything.
Locally? Wow. Are we you still doing that?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's on our website. And that's really what our business started as a retail mail order business.
So how many days a week are you cooking and packaging prepared foods?
Well, we do it. Once a week or once every couple of weeks. Depends on my supply. We make, I have a big tilt skillet. And so we make 50 100-pound batches. And then package it in 24-ounce containers. Freeze it. It's good to go.
So what's the favorite dish this time of year?
Lamb barley soup. Or a lamb pie.
Ooh.
It's a lamb pot pie. Mediterranean spices with a pie crust on top.
We won an award at the Fancy Food Show with it in 1997. It was one of
That's how long we've been cooking these things. Yeah. So I guess the recipes
Would you ever
work.
Do? Would you ever do lamb charcuterie? Would you ever do have a drying room? Make some salami or a lamb prosciutto.
Takes a long time.
It's a long time.
Takes too long. Takes too long. Over a year. Yeah. Forget it.
Yeah, I'm too anxious.
All right, fair enough.
And what we do now is we have two coolers off of the slaughter floor, and the first one that's the chapter about Julia, but we found out how to deal with tough meat when it's grass fed, and so the first cooler they go into is 55 degrees curing temperature, so we use that for that. And they chilled, the carcass chills down very slowly, and by chilling down slowly, the meat is not tough. If it's chilled down too quickly, you get this cold shortening thing that toughens it, and that's a problem with grass-fed meat. And then the next day, it goes into 35 degrees. So we utilize that temperature, so we couldn't cure at the same time.
Got it.
It's either one or the other.
Cool. So we have to take a very quick break. Stick around. We'll be right back with Suki and John Jameson.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
All right, and we're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And speaking of Roberta's, we were just talking about shipping pizzas by the pallet around the country. John was asking Brandon how often and how much are you shipping at a time?
Well, we do about 8 pallets roughly a week. Wow. that ship out. And 8 pallets is there's 12 in a case, and there's 10 cases to a pallet. So my math is real bad. I was never very good at quick math, but it's a lot.
Clearly, Brandon is not in charge of checking the pallet count before they go out the door.
I know what we're supposed to do a day, which is we do 1,600 pieces a day when we're in production. So, you know, we ship quite a bit. We're from, Pennsylvania all the way down to Georgia, and then all the way over to Tennessee. So we're in we're in the Mid-Atlantic and the Atlantic regions. We could move, and we have the capacity to move into the North Atlantic, which would
do your distributors step. Pick up, or you deliver to local warehouses?
Yeah, no, our distributor does both regions for us. So Rainforest picks up, and they do all the distribution for both of those. We do some of our own packaging and shipping for some small accounts, and then we have Gold Belly and Dean and DeLuca and some other companies that do their own shipping.
Dean and DeLuca? Mm-hmm. Still? I thought they are no more.
I know. They're still actually doing the shipping, but they're
all right.
They're tailing it away.
So we've been chatting, hopefully you've been listening before this, we've been chatting with John and Suki Jameson of Jameson Farm in Pennsylvania. So we've been talking lamb the whole show, but we'd love to hear a little bit more. What sets your lamb apart from others raised in the U.S.?
Probably the grass where we are. And the grass grows, as I always say, in April and May, you can, at the end of the day, you can go up on the porch, open a beer, and listen to the grass grow. It's growing so fast. It's just amazing in our area. And in 1900, the largest merino flocks in the country were in our area, within about five counties. Because we get the right amount of rainfall, and it's on the hills, and the grass just grown crazy, and it's wonderful. That makes a big difference. And then also the fact that we're the taste changes. So in the spring, in the early spring, it'll be garlicky. You'll taste the garlic and onion because that's the first grass we have. And then there'll be different herbs and wildflowers. So we get wild anise in the summer. And then in the fall, we'll get Queen Anne's lace, which is wild carrot. And that sweetens it just like putting carrot into a stew. So you have that change and also a very, very clean taste to the meat because of that. And then we've had our own plants for 25 years now. And so we do this high temperature conditioning thing I was talking about briefly. So it ensures that the meat's going to be tender all the way through. And then we age it for 3 to 5 days.
And what breed are your lamb?
We use various ones. What works best in our area, which is really kind of like what you do. But what we do is what is kind of indigenous to the area and works best. Typically would be a cross between a blackface English breed like Suffolk or Hampshire to a whiteface Dorset. They're grass breeds in England and they do very well. And our ewe flock right now, we have a lot of North Country Cheviot, which are British breeds too, and they do very well on grass.
What is the most indigenous breed to the East Coast?
It's whatever does well is what people
whatever
keep.
Came on the Mayflower.
Whatever came. Yeah, what was the first one here?
Yeah, I think, well, I saw that you do, and those are the rams we're putting in. I really like, my favorite probably is Horn Dorsets. And the reason is that the Paul Dorsets have been crossbred, and so they aren't really Dorsets anymore. They use larger ones like Columbias and the Western breeds because the kids that are in the fairs, competing in the fairs, want something bigger and fatter. Sure. And, you know. But the old type Horn Dorset is short and squatty, and you want short and squatty because they do better as a ruminant. That's what you want. You want, just like with cattle, you want Devons or something, or the old type Angus that can take the grass in and have room for it to
ruminate. Does short and squatty mean they have a smaller leg?
Yeah, they'll be shorter, but they'll have a wide area here. They aren't tall and lean and long, and because with those, the only way to get them fat is to feed them a lot of grain.
Yeah, but they win lots of blue ribbons.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and
that's
why the kids, the young 4-H farmers, it's all about how much money you get for the gold prize.
Yeah, you want a George Clooney.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and how many lamb are you raising each year?
About 3,000.
Wow.
So what we do is, but the way we do it is, so we have a ewe flock of maybe 200. So that's only going to be about 300-400 lambs, but we buy local lambs and then we finish them on the grass. And so they've been raised, started on grass, and then we finish them on grass and they do great. It's fine.
Do you always buy from the same source? Like, I assume you know your...
Yeah, we know where it's coming from. But I have somebody that does it for us, that buys them. And so we know what we're getting.
But you do all the slaughter and all the cutting?
Yes, we do. Yeah. So they come to the farm. We finish them on the farm. Suki, we take them through a sorting chute at the farm. Suki feels the backs and decides that the cover's right. They're in shape to go. And then we take them to the plant, which is about 5 miles away, and the day before. And then they settle down. And then we slaughter them.
Do you truck them or you shepherd them? 5 miles. I'm envisioning a snowstorm. Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like Suki's got the magic touch. Yes, it's right in the palm of your hand.
She knows. She knows.
You can sense their aura if they're ready.
Yes.
Now you write in the book that Suki does have the magic touch, and that you're the one that knows if like the rack is right, and it's all based on how their back feels.
Right.
Yeah.
You just
confirmation.
You know your gut. Yeah. Wow. Now, would you ideally, can you handle more, or is this enough for the demand to do 3,000 a year?
Yeah, the problem is, which you may know, is that, you know, the issue when you're dealing with a whole animal is getting rid of all the parts all the time. And it's difficult. So some things sell better than other things, so you just try to make it as easy as you can. For instance, it's much harder to sell the middle meats now than it was five or 10 years ago.
Everyone used to only want the loin and the racks.
Exactly.
Sure. And now it's everyone wants all the parts except for the...
That's right, because they all want to buy cheap.
Yeah.
And they all want to buy shanks because they can get shanks and they're easy to deal with. They braise them and can hold them for a couple days. And the more you cook them, the better they are.
The popularity of the shank has only keeps increasing year after year, right? And as the rack starts to kind of decrease, right?
It's with the 30 years ago. Well, when we first started, we sold shanks for dog food.
Right.
Nobody would buy them.
Yeah.
It's amazing how it switched. And the same with necks and with shoulders. The shoulders we were using in the prepared products we're talking about because nobody would buy them.
So those were good for the stews and the,
and the
pie and
the sausages.
Yes. Yeah, in our experience, you know, we typically, our mail order, when we decide how we are going to break down the whole lamb that we're bringing in and have it processed, the shoulders were always for grind. And now I've been telling my colleague Catherine, I'm like, don't grind them. I'm like, can you grind the legs instead? I need the shoulders. So it's, you know, it's interesting how there's ebb and flow in terms of popularity of cuts.
And it drives you nuts.
Well, I think a lot of this is chef driven, right? And they're looking for something unique that other people don't have. Also, they're looking for a price per pound that's palatable, right? Because you also got to sell it.
They'll call and ask for 40 necks.
Well, right.
That's 40 animals. And if you don't have them on hand, what are you going to do?
Right. And if you're only doing 3,000 of them, that's a lot. That's a lot all at once, right?
Yeah.
Right.
It's those are the things that drive us nuts.
But 40 necks, like the thing is, 40 necks doesn't even go a long way. So if you're
could be one 40, batch 40 for necks. A big restaurant, weeks worth, and then they want more.
Exactly. They want more. Exactly.
And are chefs particular that you work with about frozen versus fresh? Or do they respect the...
They understand
quality trumps everything.
They understand that when you're having like
40 necks.
Well, if I have them on hand, otherwise you're going to get frozen. With shanks, especially in
shanks
the summer.
Shanks especially, because all summer they aren't going to buy
Nobody
shanks.
Nobody wants shanks.
So we freeze them.
Right.
For sure. Right. So you're partially here. You know, you had an event last night, but also you've just published your book, Coyotes in the Pasture and Wolves at the Door, part memoir, part cookbook. Tell us a little more about the book and also the title. Where did that come from?
The title was written way before the book was. We just came up with that title. And
so what the title refers to is that the coyotes in the pasture part is what we dealt with the farm, those issues. The wolves at the door was anyone who has a small business would understand.
The industrialism.
But the banks wouldn't lend us money, and everybody that was after us, and trying to keep it going, and trying to explain to a banker in a small town in western Pennsylvania who Danielle was or who Jean-Louis Paladin was, and this is really a big deal. No, nothing happened. And so that was the issue. So, but the book itself is a compilation of stories of chefs that helped us get going, and how we just fell into becoming good friends with Julia, for instance, and Jean-Louis and Johnny Apple, who wrote for The Times, and all these things that happened to us that were just great. And then Suki has 25, I think, recipes, and it's just stuff that we use all the time. And they're one-pot recipes mostly, and simple, and because people just are freaked out when they have to cook lamb. I don't know why. I guess because they think of a rack of lamb being very expensive and they think they're going to blow it. But, you know, braised and braised dishes, the things like shepherd's pie, the lamb paprika, and the bolognese are so easy to do. And it's just great comfort food. It really is. Very tasty.
What piece do you use for the lamb paprika? Did we talk about this already?
No.
What kind of stew meat?
Yeah.
From the shoulder.
From the shoulder.
Yeah. Because so the shoulder.
Brandon's like, I can see it. You're like, tonight.
Oh, I know. It may happen. I'm telling you. It's so in my good. Head right now.
It's so good. And the shoulder is. So we made one stew with Jean-Louis. It was his recipe. And we used I wanted to get rid of the legs because it was more profitable that way. We had a higher yield from the legs. And Jean-Louis tasted it and said, you are using the leg. You have to use the shoulder. And so, because it's much more tender when you cook it like that. But then we have a recipe at 2 hours or so. But we have a recipe for 7-hour leg of lamb, which was in Patricia Wells' Bistro Cookbook. And you braise it. You braise a leg in white wine for 7 hours with root vegetables, and it's you spoon it.
Mm. Suki, I have an important question for you. Are you opposed to the Instant Pot?
I have one.
Okay.
But I haven't used it very much.
What is it?
Our son gave it to us, the Instant Pot.
It's like a pressure cooker and a crock pot all in one, and it speeds up a lot of the slower cooking, braising kind of dishes.
So I have not mastered it.
He loves it.
I'd love to I'm gonna email you, and I would love to have one of these 7-hour dishes with an Instant Pot
we should try.
We're gonna try.
One of the most important parts of a recipe is time.
I'm with you on that. But like tonight, I don't know, you're maybe not making the 7-hour
probably not 7 hours, no.
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 Well, with our legs,
but that's really Sunday. That's what you do on Saturday and Sunday, and that's what's great. But this goes back to one of the important parts of a recipe is time. If you have the time, you're going to have a better. There's going to be a better outcome. You don't always have the time,
absolutely.
So you choose recipes that you can do with the time. But I'm
going to request an amended book that has a few pages in the back and says, and if you need to make these on the fly, Suki says you can use the Instant Pot, and this is how to do it.
That's a good one. There you go. Another market. But see, what we do on the farm is because of our lifestyle, we're always on the farm. So she puts it in, and it's going to be there 5, 6, 7 hours. With our smaller legs, it's not 7 hours, five usually, 4 or 5. But somebody's always going back and forth into the kitchen. We have a big restaurant stove, a big Vulcan Heart 5-foot stove. And so you're always just kind of checking it all the time. But the longer it cooks, the better it is. So who cares?
Yeah. You know. If it goes from 5 to 7.
If you're like, oops, I had to stay out a little too long with the lamb, for sure.
Yeah. Had a couple of too many beers.
I was listening to the grass grow. So what's next for you guys? Obviously, you're very busy on the farm. And where can our listeners, do you have some book signings coming up, I think?
We do have some events in the Pittsburgh area.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, we have listeners from around the country to the podcast. So
that's good.
We have two.
Yes.
Two listeners.
Right now. Right now, one's waking up on the West Coast,
in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, exactly. What's your website? People can find more information.
www.jamisonfarm.com, JAMISONFARM.com.
Cool.
And the book's available there, as well as every cut of lamb you ever wanted.
Mm.
And it sounds like some prepared foods that we can order to be shipped to us.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. We look forward to tasting some of your lamb.
And we'll be back.
Back. Suki's got on lamb socks, I noticed.
She has her lamb socks.
I love it.
You do.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. We'll be back next week. And stick around for Taste of the Past up next. The Main Course OG is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.